versus Carlos Lizardi. Is it Ms. Martell? And is it Mr. Shinstock?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. Good morning. Good morning. Ms. Martell, glad to hear from you when you're ready. Would you care to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. At this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. That'll be granted.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Martell. I represent the appellant, Sheila Lizardi, the wife in a divorce case arising out of the Circuit Court of the County of Fairfax. This case is here on the issue of the validity of a property settlement agreement. And in a motion to determine validity, which occurred on December 20th, 2012, the Circuit Court of Fairfax County heard two separate arguments from the appellant. And that was one, that the agreement was invalid based on constructive fraud. And two,
you only argue constructive fraud, not actual fraud. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. At the trial court, only the issue of constructive fraud was raised. There had been a prior proceeding that determined that the appellant did in fact sign the 7-page document.
Counsel, let me interrupt you and see if we can crystallize these issues. The trial court here made some interesting factual findings, or
yes,
at least apparently factual findings. First of all, he found that there was actual misrepresentation here, and I would suggest that certainly seems to be supported by the record. But nevertheless, found no special relationship, and finally, basically determined that in any event, distribution of the property would have been substantially different anyway. So it seems to me where we're at in terms of the factual background. And I guess my first question would be, in terms of the finding that no special relationship existed, what's your position as to whether that's a factual finding, a mixed question of law and fact, or a totally de novo review by us?
Well, I believe that this is a mixed question of law and fact. Factually, in fact, the judge stated, the Honorable Judge Devine stated on the record, that he believed that there was evidence of a special relationship, but that it didn't meet the burden of clear evidence.
Barnes versus Barnes says, it talks about, I guess these factors are not necessarily dispositive, but it talks about several factors that would give rise to a special relationship. Whether the parties have separated, they certainly separated here. Where they've employed independent counsel, which they apparently had not at this time, and then are negotiating in an arm's length transaction. Well, it seems to me implicit in the court's finding of a misrepresentation, we have at least some indication that this is not an arm's length transaction. I mean, there's some language issues, some trust issues. So I guess I'm trying to just understand from the parties where the parties think this court is with regard to how we review that particular issue.
I think it needs to be reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, and I know that's a higher burden than de novo review, but here we believe that there is, with the evidence submitted on the record, that there is in fact evidence meeting the burden of clear and convincing, that there was in fact, by a clear and convincing standard of proof, a special relationship between the parties. And as Your Honor pointed out, I think we look at the case law, we look both to Barnes and Webb, that tells us generally these are some factors. However, we're going to look at, in Barnes and Webb, we see the court point out that the existence of a special relationship is going to be case specific. It's going to be looked at.
So just to clarify, follow up on Judge Humphrey's question, whether there's constructive fraud is a mixed question. The ultimate legal question of whether there's constructive fraud, once you've looked at the facts and they're applied to the law, that would be de novo. But basic factual questions would be credible evidence, abuse of discretion. Is
correct,
that right?
Your Honor. That's our position on this.
But is there any real dispute here about the factual issues? In other words, no one seems to dispute that the parties, for example, hadn't employed counsel at the time of this PSA being agreed to.
I thought there was counsel, but not at that time. There was counsel earlier.
There had been counsel 2 years before.
Okay.
But at this point, at the point that the agreement was entered into, that agreement was drafted by Mr. Lizardi, and they had not employed, neither one of them had employed counsel for now a period of 2 years.
Is this something his previous lawyer had just given him as a, or he found this out of a?
No, he testified that he found this on the internet and that he had drafted this document.
Let me follow up on Judge Beal's question. It seems to be the biggest problem you have from a factual standpoint here is the trial court's factual finding, I quote, "And I do believe this document is not one that Mrs. Lizardi would have voluntarily signed if she believed it was going to affect her rights going forward," close quotes. Given that, you know, if that's a factual finding supported by the evidence, then the question is, what's the relationship between the parties at that point? That certainly would suggest, given the misrepresentation and the fact that the trial court said she wouldn't have signed it if she'd known what it was. Now, if there's no special relationship, in other words, if the parties have counsel and all that stuff, then it doesn't matter because you're supposed to rely on the advice of counsel, not on the husband you're trying to unload or whatever. So I mean, this is a really kind of a convoluted legal issue in the sense that, you know, we've got these factual, undisputed situation, but how do we apply the law to that? You know, in this case, the special relationship definition to that. On the one hand, English is not her first language, as I understand
from
the
correct.
Record. She relied upon her separated husband to tell her. She indicated she trusted him. Trial court, obviously, implicitly at least, concluded that that was factually accurate, given this statement the trial court made. And then yet concluded that there's no special relationship. And I'm trying to understand how you get from there to there, given all these factual findings the trial court, in fact, did make. Now, in the final analysis, it may not make a difference, you know, but I'm not at that point yet. I'm still trying to understand what the special relationship situation is.
I think it's important to note that in the record, Judge Devine specifically stated that during his findings of facts, when he made his ruling, he specifically stated that he did, in fact, find there was a special relationship between the parties, that they trusted each other. He found that element, although existing, didn't rise to the level of clear and convincing.
Isn't that a factual finding?
Exactly. He's made his factual finding and then applied a legal test to it, and that's reviewable de novo by us.
Yeah, and the legal part of that, the non-factual finding, the legal part of that is, in fact, we believe, a de novo review by this court. And in looking at that, you would then use...
So just to clarify on that, by saying, okay, I find there is a level of trust in a special relationship, but I don't think it was established by clear and convincing evidence. When he said that last part, applying clear and convincing, you think that then makes it a de novo review?
Yes. I think that makes it a de novo review by this court. And in that case, I think that in looking at the evidence of a special relationship that in fact is in the record based on a clear and convincing standard, I think it's important to note here, not only how Judge Humphreys pointed out that, you know, she stated that she trusted the husband. There's evidence on the record that the husband trusted her with his checkbook. So that when he was overseas, she was writing her own checks from his separate account. The husband also testified that after the parties had separated, they had refinanced the marital home. And I think that's important because that was also, according to Judge Devine.
But the trial judge found that happened before the separation, didn't he? Didn't he make a finding in his ultimate ruling that they refinanced and she ended up with all the marital debt when they refinanced, but that happened before the separation, shortly before the separation.
The judge did make that statement, but that wholeheartedly contradicts Mr. Lozardi's testimony, who's the only person that testified as to when that refinance occurred, that he believed it occurred about a year after the parties had separated. That can be found in the joint appendix at 195. And that's the only testimony on that issue. And I think that what in here, it's important that these are parties that trusted each other. There was a special relationship. The parties were not in an adversarial situation. very much opposed to that. They did not have counsel at the time. It had been 2 years since they even had counsel.
But wasn't their testimony that was uncontradicted, including by Mrs. Lizardi, that said, you know, yes, we've discussed these issues before, but we never could resolve them because every time we would end up fighting about it. And we would argue, and then it was dropped. And so I never would have agreed to this because it came up before. So we fussed about it, and that was it. So that she was saying that in regard to why she wouldn't have signed this had she known what was in it. But isn't there an indication that their relationship wasn't good and they had employed counsel in the past because of that?
I would disagree, Your Honor, and this is mainly... because I think parties, even in a marital relationship, often have disagreements on issue, and often there is issues between parties that are in fact in a special relationship that are married that brings contention. Both parties disagree. That doesn't mean that a special relationship doesn't exist. In fact,
had their situation improved, so that's why they hadn't had counsel for a couple of years, and so now they'd gone from at arm's length to now back to more of a trusting relationship? Is there evidence of that in the record?
I believe that there is evidence of that, especially since we see that the signing of this agreement actually occurred on Christmas. The parties got together, they had Christmas dinner, they opened presents, and this was towards the end of the evening.
Here's another present for you.
Right. And I think, and here it's important to note, Judge Devine specifically said he believed the testimony that Mr. Lizardi stated that this was a document necessary for a home that he was purchasing, for the financing on a home that he was purchasing, and that he stated that, and that that's the only reason that Ms. Lizardi signed the document was because she trusted him that this was in fact a document for the bank and not a property settlement agreement. I think that's important because that tends to show the existence of a special relationship. If you're in an adversarial situation with your separated spouse and they present you a document and you've been negotiating back and forth with attorneys, well, it's presumed that that document is going to relate to the separation of the marriage and the separation of the assets.
Can you confirm about the filing of taxes? That
yes.
Up until that point in time, they had always filed their taxes jointly together.
That's correct.
You're into your rebuttal time, but I want you to go ahead and finish your answer.
And I'll just mention quickly, yes, the parties did in fact file joint tax returns, which is important. I'll also address briefly the issue of that the agreement was unconscionable. Judge Devine did in fact find overreaching, again, but found that in this instance, there wasn't gross disparity on the assets. And I think that's important because he did make a finding that she received half of what she would have received otherwise. In a 19 and a half year marriage, she received half of what she would have gotten. But it becomes gross disparity when you add in the fact that she takes all the debt. And I think that's important.
But can I ask you on that really quick?
Yes, Your Honor.
She asked for the highs. She really wanted the highs. And the trial judge found that that was extremely important to her. So how do you answer with regard to that? That was a major thing that she got that she wanted in the furniture.
That's correct, but I think it was important that, and I think it's visible from the record, that she wanted the home, but obviously with assistance from the husband on paying that home. And I think that's important because she is taking all the debt. That's why there's no equity in the home. It's not that she wanted the home even without his assistance. And I'll reserve the remaining of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Schoenstock.
Thank you. I want to start immediately with this idea that, as represented by counsel just now, that there was a finding by the trial court of a special relationship. The trial court never made that finding whatsoever. Specifically what the trial court did, and I would refer the court to pages appendix 317 and 318, is it made an indication that there might be some evidence to suggest, I think the word he used was a tendency or tend to show, that there might be a special relationship. But then he expressly found there wasn't a special relationship in this instance.
Or did he find that it wasn't shown by clear and convincing evidence?
That's correct. That is true, Judge.
Is that a factual finding, or is that a mixed finding, because he's applied the clear and convincing standard?
Yeah, I think it's a factual finding in that it's based on facts, but I don't deny, obviously, he's applying the legal standard of clear and convincing, but it's wholly predicated on the underlying facts in the record before him. So I don't know if I've answered that question as you posed it, but it's 100% facts that go into the determination of whether they constitute a clear and convincing standard of proof. He found that it didn't.
Can I follow up then and ask you on this question? I mean, this is Christmas Eve. She has invited him to the very important celebration that they have both testified is very important to them, in the most important day of the year. And they're with her family, and they've been eating, drinking, and opening presents. And then he gives her this on the way out, essentially. If there wasn't a special relationship at that point, and they hadn't had counsel in 2 years, if that's correct.
That's disputed, Judge.
Okay. When would there have been a special relationship?
Prior to the separation, Judge. Now, let's be
only prior to separation.
Yeah,
it's a bright line.
I believe it is in this case, Judge, and here, let me tell you why. Let's not forget what the context of the argument was in the lower court and in this court in that regard. The argument in this court and in the lower court was that there was a special relationship post-separation because of the financial handlings of their financial lives by Mr. Lazzardi. That was the argument. That was what was before the court. And so he looked at that evidence, that's what he was asked to do, and he made very specific and lengthy findings about how that was not the case.
Let me follow up on Judge Beal's question. It seems to me, and this is, I'm just confused about, maybe you can help straighten me out. As you correctly point out, the trial court ultimately found no special relationship here. Yet, in applying the Barnes criteria, the only criteria it seems to me that's satisfied here is the fact that the parties have separated. So in terms of evidence supporting, and I'm starting from the proposition that the issue of whether a special relationship exists or not is one we review de novo because it's a question of law. And the facts are, have the parties separated, have they employed counsel, things of that nature, to which it seems to me there's no serious dispute. So they've not employed independent counsel at this time. They're negotiating this property settlement that the wife doesn't even know is a property settlement. In fact, they're not negotiating at all. She's just being asked to sign it. And the trial court has made this finding that, although he didn't use the words, it seems to me implicitly that it clearly was not an arm's length transaction. So it seems to me the question is, has the fiduciary relationship that comes with the marriage been terminated if the only evidence of the Barnes criteria is the separation?
I do respectfully disagree with that assessment of the state of the evidence and the record in this case, Judge Humphreys. Let me point out the following facts that the trial court had before in that regard. These parties had been separated without break for 5.5 years. Both were in complete agreement that there was no chance and had never been during the separation a chance to save the marriage. My client had not lived with Ms. Velez, Ms. Lazzardi, for about 5.5 years, was not in the same household. They had, in fact, been to two separate set of counsel in this case, to include in 2010. Mr. Lazzardi testified, this is on appendix page 163, 164, goes on for about 2 or 3 pages, that he went to counsel in 2010, a second round of counsel. They had both been to a prior round of counsel in 2007, 2008. And then he testifies about him being aware of his wife actually also going to another counsel. And from the record, I glean that to be in 2010, and I think the court has to take it that way.
But were either represented by counsel at the time this was signed?
I'm not aware of any evidence in this record, Judge Beals, that says specifically I was not represented by counsel at this time. I could be stand corrected on that, but I don't recall that being affirmative evidence in this case.
And can I follow up on that? Up until that point, I'll ask you what I ask opposing counsel, hadn't they always filed through this point their taxes jointly?
Up until 2009. And to be fair, this agreement was signed in December 2010,
right.
so they couldn't have filed.
They wouldn't have been working on 2010 until after this.
That's correct. And they did not file. The evidence is that they did not file joint tax returns after that date. Also, it has to be stressed here that these parties engaged in substantial negotiations regarding this property settlement agreement that was ultimately arrived at. They went through multiple rounds. They had heated discussions. She disagreed with aspects of the agreement.
Doesn't that cut against you as well as for you, though? Because if that's the case, it's on Christmas Eve, and all of a sudden she's signing what she had vigorously said she would not agree to.
But that gives credence to the idea that there was a duty in this instance, imposed that she didn't have to read the agreement, that there was an obligation or a non-obligation for her not to have to read the agreement. And there is an obligation that she has to read this agreement. And she didn't, and she chose not to.
She trusted him. She said she trusted him. The trial court apparently accepted that fact.
That's right. The court accepted that she said that. The court didn't and expressly found that she was wrong in that sense, that she had an obligation to read the agreement before she signed it. And simply saying that I didn't because I trusted my husband that I've been separated from 5 years in the course of substantial negotiations, we discussed and had heated discussions about these points. She had every reason to need to read and should be able to read. And I would submit to the court that as a public policy matter, we need to tell those kind of litigants in those instances that they should be reading these property settlement agreements before they sign.
No question that you should read it, but given the context of the situation, he says, he's on the way at the door after a long family celebration. She's been drinking, they've been eating, exchanging gifts, and he hands her this and says, I need this to be able to purchase a house in Maryland. And she then signs it on Christmas Eve because he's leaving. I mean, she could have, of course, said, I want to read it. No question about that. But given his representation of what it was, there's no special relationship in that at all.
In fact, we're very clear on that there was a pre-existing adversarial relationship that had never been broken by way of a change. None. So there is no indication that there would be a recreation of the special relationship, and no evidence was induced at the trial
as to
how that would have happened.
Totally disagree with opposing counsel that because they'd been represented by counsel and now apparently were not at this point in time, or he wouldn't have probably drafted it himself, that things hadn't improved at least a bit?
No, I really don't, Judge. I mean, I think the hard answer to that is that there was an established adversarial relationship and there was no break in that chain. She was very much aware that this was a situation where they were separated and that they were at arm's length. And by the way, the court found it was an arm's length transaction ultimately.
But he still would leave his checkbook with her after they were separated when he was on deployment and depend on her to pay the bills and not overspend his account, right? I mean, so there were things that were done, I guess, as my question to you, after separation that don't necessarily indicate this was a relationship that didn't involve trust or some sort of special aspects that many divorced couples would never do or separated couples would never do with each other.
I'm not so sure that really bears out, though, Judge Beals, in this instance. For example, I don't recall that the testimony in that specific instance regarding the checkbook was post-separation.
So that was pre-separation?
I think that was pre-separation. But frankly, we're still back to the situation that they had been separated. They had been not living under the same roof. They had gone through separate counsel, multiple counsel. They had talked to that counsel about the specifics of the negotiations.
Let me ask you about the last issue. The judge made alternative findings here, and essentially concluded that it really didn't matter because even if the equitable distribution formula, the statutory considerations had been applied, the result would have been not drastically different from what it was. Your opponent argues that that's, you know, error as a matter of law, but obviously there's some factual considerations there, and again, we have to, you know, we're stuck with whatever the factual conclusions are if they're supported by the evidence. Now here, it is clear the wife wanted the house and got it, but she also got all the debt. Now I guess the question is whether, you know, to what extent was that a reasonable expectation given the overall situation, irrespective of the sole special relationship?
Sure. Let's stress what she got was solely the secured debt against the house, a house that she acquired the possession of that she very much wanted. And Judge Devine, in making his ruling in this respect, made a very important point on that, which is, you know, people don't always enter this for solely financial reasons. They have emotional reasons as well, and that clearly happened here with the house. A house that she very much wanted, that she resided in with both the one remaining minor child and the two adult children in the marriage. So this was something that she very much wanted, she negotiated for, and she received it. And let's not forget that she received child support. That was guideline child support. She received alimony, $1,500 a month.
But can I follow up on that? Because the trial judge seemed to find specifically that had this gone to the guidelines the way it's normally done, that she would have probably gotten, at least in the first few years, about twice the amount of spousal support she was getting, because she would have gotten about $1,500 from the retirement, military retirement pay, and she would have gotten $1,250 to $1,500, I believe he said, in spousal support.
Oh, no doubt about it, Judge. If she had taken this to equitable distribution, she would have likely gotten an income stream from both the retirement and the alimony, and under the property settlement agreement as negotiated, the alimony was essentially only for 5 years, ended, and then the retirement stream kicked in. So that's true. But it's not true to say that the court found that she would have gotten double the amount of alimony. I'm not aware of the trial court ever making that finding in this record.
Well, double the amount of support, because you would add the military, which she would get as long as she didn't remarry, along with however many years he would have had to pay spousal support alimony. And so maybe alimony isn't the correct term, but the total amount of support would have been almost double.
I think it's problematic to say that, though, Judge Fields. And the reason for that is that in Virginia, we don't have a defined mechanism as a formula mathematically to determine permanent alimony in these cases. We certainly have some barometers that we look to, but the court's not bound by them, and they often disregard them, both up and down.
Isn't that, though, what he seemed to be saying he would have done, Judge Devine, had there not been a PSA governing this?
Oh, make no doubt about it, and he was making all those kind of findings when we got to unconscionability. Make no doubt about it that he was making a finding and looking at the disparate aspects of it, because his first prong obligation in that respect was to define whether it was grossly disparate as an exchanged value. And there is disparate analysis and exchange here for the retirement and the alimony because, yes, as I said before, 5 years, no retirement until the alimony ends. That's disparate. He found that. That happened. But it's not grossly disparate. Not at all. And I would submit, to be more specific, on the alimony amount.
Gross disparity a factual finding?
It is. Well, it's entitled to the inferences and the deductions from the record that are favorable to my client in this instance, and as a legal conclusion from that, yes, it is a legal finding. But it was the disparate, it needs to be stressed in this case. She got the house, she got the better car, she got almost all of the furniture and furnishings, she got alimony for 5 years, which coupled with the prior 5 years
of other than the furnishings, though, there was no equity, as he pointed out, in the house or in the car.
No, the direct evidence on that was from Mr. Lizardi, and the furniture was worth perhaps tens of thousands of dollars. There was evidence that the house had no equity. But I would submit to you, and this was something found by Judge Devine in this instance, a house can't be purely assessed from a financial standpoint in that. She got the house, she got the possession, she got to be able to maintain it. And the evidence in this case, by the way, is by 2012, when this issue came up before the court in December, she was still in the house.
Can I ask you about the attorney's fees?
Sure.
The agreement was drawn by your client, and so has to, if there are any, there's uncertainty, it has to be construed strictly against him, correct?
That is certainly the parole evidence rule, yes.
Why, if you look at paragraph 14 on enforcement, which talks about two ways that attorney's fees could be granted, and then you look at 18 as well as the severability portion, and then the portion that talks about each party bearing its own counsel fees, why isn't there enough contradiction in there that essentially attorney's fees should be borne by each side?
That's a good question. Because it's not an ambiguity analysis that we're getting into there. When you look at the enforcement provision, paragraph 14, it deals specifically with any costs for enforcement. It's very specific. There's no ambiguity there at all. If you read an ambiguity into it and you say that that subsequent provision, or maybe an earlier provision about the cost of divorce being borne by both parties, you render that phrase not ambiguous. You render it nonsensical. You render it meaningless in the context of this setting. It doesn't say that. It's quite specific in its intended meaning, its specifics. It says any costs. So it's not an ambiguity analysis at all. It's a specific reading of the property settlement agreement as expressly provided.
So anyone who challenges the PSA at all and loses has to pay all the expenses related to this disputed divorce?
Yes, but with a limitation. It has to be for enforcement, and it has to be reasonable fees. That's expressly what the agreement provides.
All right, thank you, Counselor. Time is up.
The judge specifically found in this case that the only reason Ms. Lizardi signed the agreement, and these are specific findings by Judge Devine, of fact, that the only reason Ms. Lizardi signed the agreement is because she believed what the husband was telling her about the fact that this was only necessary for him to obtain financing on a home. It was something necessary for the bank. The judge specifically found that, and that the reason that she did it, he went on to say, so we know what the judge's thinking was in finding that, he went on to say it was because Ms. Lizardi trusted him. That, Your Honors, shows.
But that doesn't end the analysis. I mean, your opponent's point is simply that, you know, that's tough. She shouldn't have trusted him because there's no fiduciary duty any longer. And so she should have sought counsel. She should have, you know, looked, read what she, before she signed, all that sort of thing.
And, Your Honor, I think to answer that question, we look at why she trusted him. And that's the analysis that Barnes tells us to do, is that we look at the case specific. Here, they filed joint tax returns. In order to do so, they would have had to share their financial information. They shared, he shared with her his own separate checking account where she was able to sign checks, and I'll specifically refer to the joint appendix at 371, where the wife, after the separation, was using the husband's checkbooks while he was deployed or overseas.
So that was definitely after separation.
Yes, after separation. There was also evidence in the record at Appendix 195.
How close in that was to 2010, to December 2010?
Answer Judge Beal's question, then your time will be up.
Yes, Your Honors. I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you could...
How close in time to December 2010, when the PSA was signed, did she have his checkbook?
That's not clear in the record, Your Honor, exactly when that was. But it is that it's after some point after when they're separated... that he's overseas.
Sometime between 2005 and 2010.
That's correct, Your Honor, during that period of time where they were also filing joint tax returns. I appreciate Your Honors. Thank you.
All right, we'll come down to Greek Council.